Good morning. Good morning. I want to start by thanking our shakuhachi player, Leo Hansen, for gracing us with his presence yet again. Do you want to say something about what you played this morning, or the shakuhachi, Leo?
Well, there are two pieces I played this morning. The first one was Akiwan no Shirabi, which was kind of a search for the sunrise, whatever the Buddhist term it could be, in searching for enlightenment. This was kind of a leisure piece that was played by this priest in their free time.
Wow. I see.
The second one was Mirasaki no Kyoto, which is the color of purple, the music of purple, which meant sort of this priest who composed the piece was maybe standing in a field with purple flowers. So.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. So this morning I'm going to talk about concentration or samadhi, and those of you who were here on Thursday get to hear this again. Oh boy. Although it'll be different, but it'll kind of be the same. Okay, so samadhi, or let's just say concentration, the eighth stage in the Eightfold Path, concentration. And these are the three last stages in the Eightfold Path are the internal practices. So concentration then is the final of the internal practices. And one of the key uses of concentration is with the breath in all of Buddhist practice. The breath is one of the key ways that it's used. So our breath. Our breath is so simple. So simple, but our breath, we don't pay attention to a lot of the time. And then when we're told to pay attention to it when we get into zazen, it just seems, into meditation, it just seems kind of boring, kind of like, just that? Just the breath? But if we think about it, the breath is what sustains our life. It's what we come into the world breathing, we go out of the world stopping our breath. I used to have a friend who was kind of an acquisitive meditator, not like you guys. and he used to say that he used to try to watch a teacher breathe before he decided if he was going to hang out with that teacher. See how the teacher breathed, not just in sitting, but you know, just generally. And if the teacher was breathing, full breathing, breathing deeply, just naturally, spontaneously, then he thought, well, he would spend time with that teacher. So, as I said on Thursday, I would urge that you guys do some evaluation. There are several Buddhist centers around. Check them out. Get out your scorecards and check them out. I really wouldn't urge that. Not that I want you to come here, but that's kind of gets you off on the wrong footing, on an acquisitive footing, when this is unacquisitive. This breath doesn't have to be acquired. It's already coming up. So it's not about acquiring. And we don't notice it. So much of our lives, we don't even notice it. I learned how to notice breathing before my first child was born, because we went to, in those days, Lamaze, you know, many, many years ago. That was the breathing that we did, my wife and I. And we had class after class, and we breathed and breathed and breathed. And so I had enough breathing already in Zen, and I had to go breathe at night and breathe in the morning. But the Lamaze was a specific approach, and I don't even remember it very well. Then for my second child, again, only by that time Lamaze was outdated or something, so we did a natural breathing. We went to natural breathing classes, and we breathed together, breathed and breathed and breathed. Wonderful though. That giving birth to our breath, giving birth to the world, giving birth to life. Life is always waiting for us to give birth to it. All we have to do is just get in synchronicity with what is, with what is. And I know it's not that easy. I know it's not that easy. Linda and I spent so much time preparing for our first, for our, it was hers, but it was mine too, our first birth. And then she was in so much excruciating pain. And we, and I kept having to remind her, breathe, breathe, and she didn't want to hear it anymore. So I quit reminding her. I thought, no. And I just breathed myself. I tried to breathe for both of us. But it was very painful. So this practice sometimes gets very painful. When you breathe in all sorts of shit. You know, you're not protected from anything. You're just here vulnerable with what is, with what's coming up. So it's painful to bring that stuff in. But that shit is nothing. I mean, it's just refuse that's passing through. It's just flotsam and jetsam on the ocean of life. That's all it is. It ultimately has no substance, but it feels like it. It feels painful. It hurts. So then for our second child, our second child, our little tiny baby girl child, who was really tiny, and she still is, really tiny, she barely sort of peaked, she just flowed out as we were breathing. We breathed her out. But we didn't breathe her out. We didn't breathe her out. We were just in synchronicity with what was happening. This is all it's about, is getting in synchronicity with what's already happening. But it takes effort because we're so out of whack. We get so out of focus and so concerned and upset about what has been or what might be instead of just breathing. And our breath becomes, if we pay attention to it, a simple mirror for our lives. It's a simple mirror. When our heart is closed, what's our breath like? Where are we breathing? Shallow, constrained breathing, right? Constricted breathing. When we're open, we're feeling pretty happy, pretty satisfied. Deeper, more available breathing. So it's a pretty good mirror for our lives. And in Zen, we don't emphasize changing the breathing. Many other spiritual disciplines, yes, but not so much. Just seeing it, just being with it, just going with it. And sometimes, when the breath is open, we'll feel connected, and sometimes when it's closed, we'll feel disconnected. So then we can just be with that disconnection. That's our meditation practice at that moment. Not to say, oh shit, oh, you know, how can I change this? I'm no good. But just to be with it. Just to be with it. It's still breathing. It's still breathing. So, I think that the first part of concentration, whether it's breathing or something else you're using, you may not be using breathing, but you should ease into it. You should ease into it. You shouldn't turn it into a huge project. Just ease into it. Calm yourself down. If it takes you 2 minutes to calm yourself down for the first 2 minutes of your meditation, if it takes you 20 minutes to calm yourself down, do an easy breathing. And then, or if you're not breathing, maybe do some little prayer to yourselves to calm yourself down. Because if you start with really, really concentrated focus without easing, your concentrated focus will be very jagged and very tight. And so the first part is just to ease in, just to feel the breath wherever it is. And if you can't do that, say a prayer. Say a gata, say a mantra. Give yourself some encouragement, just a few times over and over. Nothing big, nothing fancy, just something that resonates till you're eased down enough, and then start the concentration. because it's all concentration anyway. It's all samadhi anyway. And then when you're ready, you can start really focusing. Really focusing. And, you know, all of the Eastern meditation traditions in the world, including the Shakuhachi, are about focus. They're all about focus. You can't find one that doesn't emphasize focusing, that doesn't emphasize one-pointedness, that doesn't emphasize making an attempt to fuse yourself with your object, with your subject. Even though we're already fused, still we make that attempt. Whether it's Hasidic meditation or Lakota meditation, which I practice, or Zen meditation, or whatever, Tibetan meditation, Jesus prayer, right? Jesus prayer, Hail Mary, full of grace. What's the matter with Hail Mary, full of grace? If Mary is your avatar, if Mary is your kind of your personal a being, you have a personal mythological relationship with. Why not Mary? Who cares? I mean, you care. You can develop. You can find in yourself what works, what really resonates, what calls you, what calls your no soul. Right? I mean, you can learn to focus. That's what this is about. Focusing, focusing, focusing. Because we're so scattered. Because our mind is all over the place. Because we're missing the presence of the present. We're somewhere else. So only by focusing, 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 can we come back to this? Can we be with this? And focus is very powerful. One-pointedness is very powerful. And you have a magnifying glass. As we kids, we tip our magnifying glasses and we went out and looked for plants with the sun. And then my friends looked for ants, too, and demolished them. I don't know if any of you young boys did that when you were young boys, but us young boys did. A lot of power into just this focus. A lot of energy. This is our Buddha nature. This is our nature that's waiting to be acclaimed, acknowledged, and tapped into. And then, as you do this, as you continue with this practice, you'll experience some space. You may experience this much space, or this much space. But you will experience some space. And isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? This is practice is to teach us to relate to something that's less busy and full than our lives usually are. Something that's less busy. Which is not a thing. Not a thing. And that will happen through your meditation. I can't say when or how, but if you do this, it will happen. It's inevitable. It's inevitable, and that's wonderful. W.S. Merwin in this poem says, first, forget what time it is for an hour. Do it regularly every day. Then forget what day of the week it is and do this regularly in company for a week. Then forget what country you were in and practice doing it in company for a week. And then do them together for a week with as few breaks as possible. Follow these by forgetting how to add or to subtract. It makes no difference. You can change them around after a week. Both will later help you how to forget how to count. Forget how to count, starting with your own age, starting with how to count backwards, starting with even numbers, with Roman numerals, starting with fractions, with the old calendar, going on to the alphabet, forgetting it all until everything is continuous and whole again. And at some point, the breathing just breathes itself. At some point, there's a natural a natural rhythm that is already going on, that we just fall into. That we just fall into. And you have to have faith that that will happen. Whether you have a busy mind or you don't have a busy mind, that that will happen if you continue this. That will happen. And you know, our situation is kind of sad in the United States, but maybe the rest of the world, I only live in the United States, kind of sad that most people never saw the beginning or the end of a breath in their whole lives. Unless they were, I mean, well, maybe if they were doing childbirth things, they did. Yes. But other than that, they didn't. Because they were somewhere else. They were somewhere else. Instead of being here. Instead of accepting this wonderful present that's being given to us. This wonderful, full of awe, sometimes awful, full of awe presence. Right? So I first became aware of my breath in a way that I remember, that is, when I fell out of a tree. When I was going to school, I think, maybe kindergarten or something. And those were the days when kids, you know, could go home from school by themselves and stuff. Remember those days? Kids just wandering around. Remember what that was like? What was going on then? What's happened? We just wandered around, you know. So my hometown, I fell out of a tree into a dry creek bed, I think coming home from kindergarten. I mean, that's what I think, but I don't know. And I fell on my chest, and it was there were a huge pile of leaves in the tree on the bed of the creek, and I couldn't breathe, and I thought I was dying. That's when I first noticed this thing about breathing. And there was a kid who'd been with me. I think we were walking home from kindergarten together. I really don't know. And I said, tell Mom I'm dying. And he ran home to tell my mother I was dying. But as soon as I said, tell Mom I'm dying, I breathed. And I was very aware of my breathing the whole rest of the day. I really appreciated it, at least until I got home and saw what my sister was up to, that she shouldn't have been, since it was my job to keep her in shape. So breathing. But breathing is just one example of samadhi practice. There are lots of samadhi practices. But breathing, I think, is sort of the core one, but you can make others the core too. And it takes commitment. It takes effort. It takes, because I make it sound easy, but it's not easy. I know that. I've been doing it for years. My mind still wanders. Still wanders. I still have to go through this process sometimes of just easing down before I even start the concentration. And I'll probably be doing that, you know, the day before I die. Because this is not, somehow we as human beings have gotten so addicted to our internal radio program, so addicted to this story, and to this multiplicity of stories that come out of the main theme, which is moi, right? This multiplicity of stories, that this is a hard practice for us. But it's also wonderful, because just a few moments of being in the present, in this presence, makes it all worth it. Makes it all worth it. So here's a story about a student who comes to the teacher, and he says to the teacher, please teach me samadhi practice. And the teacher says, you're not really sincere. You know, it's one of these Zen stories, right? You're not really sincere. What do you mean I'm not sincere? I want to learn. The teacher says, go away. You know, I've never known any Zen teachers like this. None that I ever met were like this, but in the books they're all like this. Isn't it interesting, isn't it? I don't know what the deal is. Maybe this is a part I haven't learned yet. Go away. And the young man comes back again and again. Finally, the young man comes and he says, I really want to learn samadhi practice. I really want to learn concentration practice. Teacher says, no, you don't. And he grabs him and throws him in the water, and he holds his head down under the water. The boy is kicking and screaming. Finally, he lets him up when he's just about blue and out of breath. The young man asks, why did you do that? The teacher says, when you want to learn what I have to teach as much as you wanted that breath, then you can come and I'll teach you. Then you can come and I'll teach you. So you do have to want this. You have to, first of all, believe that it's possible and then want it. And then you have to be willing to put up with all of the times it isn't working. And all the boredom and all the additional confusion that comes up when it's not working for you. As if you didn't have enough already. You've got a whole new layer of confusion. You have to be willing to do that. And if you continue, according to the teaching and according to experience of teachers, you may experience at some point some enlightenment, or maybe just some light. Maybe you'll just experience a lightness in your life. That's fine. Some special enlightenment can make you kind of heavy because you think, oh boy, but just lightness. So you can experience that. We can experience that. And sometimes we can experience a great light. Especially if we just had 7 days of sitting. And one or two people during that 7 days experienced a real light. What's called in the Tibetan Book of the Dead? Remember the Tibetan Book of the Dead? Any of you who are like me, I don't know, 60s people, I guess, Tibetan Book of the Dead. When we used the Tibetan Book of the Dead, right? When we were taking acid. Sorry, get into that, but that's when we use it. Now, I don't think the Tibetan teachers recommend that. The Great White Light. It's all about the Great White Light. Well, it's not all about the Great White Light. It's just that when your mind is completely still and everything opens up, sometimes you experience the brilliance of the sun, the sky, of all-penetrating light. You just experience it. And there's not even any you commenting when there's that experience. There's no you commenting. Some of you remember the Ralph Moody books about near-death experiences. How many of those near-death experiences included really calming down, really letting go of judgment and experiencing great light? I would say, I haven't read those experiences in years, but very high percentage. Very high percentage. So that's something that is a product of your meditation, if you stick with it, especially if you do long periods of meditation. And you do long periods of meditation for long times. Because this is a process that takes a while. I said the other day, and I hope I didn't discourage people, that it might take you as long to get out of this mess as it did for you to get into it in the first place. I mean, when you think about it, when you become as habituated to something as we are to our story, and how many years have we been habituated to that? How many years has that been the focus for our lives? Well, how many years is it going to take us to let go of that habituation? A while. But we can have glimmers along the way at any point. Somebody the other day I was talking to, and the first time they sat down for meditation had an experience of real lightness that they hadn't had since they were a kid. And I thought, congratulations. I said, congratulations. You need to congratulate yourself just for doing this. If you do, that will begin to lighten the process. You'll begin to not take on this meditation as one of these projects you have to master or else. Because when you do that, your inner critic takes over. And your inner critic doesn't have much lightness. Doesn't have much lightness. Maybe you can infuse some lightness into your inner critic, but it takes incredible compassion and patience to do that. And you can do that, actually. So the haiku by Basho, who was a meditator, but did long walking meditation and short sitting meditation, because he walked the countryside of Japan, meditating and writing poetry. In plum flower scent, pop, the sun appears. In plum flower scent, pop, the sun appears. Samadhi, pop, the sun appears. The sun's all already here, but it's behind the clouds. Behind the clouds. But whether it's behind the clouds or not, it's still here. It's still enlightening everything. But then it really appears. And when that happens, there's a realization, as I've been saying to the people who are in retreat, that fear is always about something that hasn't come. And anger is always about something in the past. So what about the present? Lightness. Innate lightness. How could it be different? How could it be different? So, Jack Kornfield has this long description of this biologist and him learning to become a biologist, which I'm going to read. I'll read it. This is a biologist named Agassiz. There's a big museum of glass flowers at Harvard. He was one of the great botanists around the turn of the century and before. A student of his went to begin his training as a botanist in the 1880s, and Agassiz took him and said, "You want to learn to be a botanist or a biologist? Or do you want to learn? You want to learn to be either a botanist or a biologist? Here, take this fish." And he took this kind of dead fish, and he set it on a piece of glass in front of him, and he said to Agassiz, "Study it, observe it, and tell me what you can see about it." Then he went away. He left the student there in the morning, and he went away for the whole damn day. The student stayed there for a while. He looked. There's a dumb dead fish, right? He really got bored and more irritated that his mentor and teacher didn't come back. That's like what Suzuki Roshi used to do with us. He'd just leave us meditating. I don't know what he was be doing. And sometimes the 40-minute sits went on for an hour and 20 minutes. He really got bored and more irritated that his mentor and teacher didn't come back. What did he want? Sure, it's a fish. It's got fins. It's got eyes. It's got scales. It's got six fins. It's a six-fin fish. And it's got a little yellow over near the gills. There was nothing especially interesting about it. It was like many he'd seen before. Scales, mouth, eyes. Yes, a tail. In an hour, he had thought he had seen all there was to see. All there was to see. Time rolled on, and the teacher didn't come back for a long time. He was getting angrier and more irritated. Finally, after he'd gotten back from lunch, he was so discouraged. He wished the dumb old man had given him something more interesting. Then, in order to kill time, he sat down with a piece of paper and he started to draw the fish. "All right, I'll draw it." In drawing, he began to notice things. He discovered, for example, the way that the scales overlap one another. And then he began to see, as he drew the eyes, that the fish didn't have any eyelids. Then he began to see the textures of the veins in the scales. He kept on looking and drawing, and it got very interesting to him. And he drew for a whole afternoon into the evening. Agassiz came and looked at his drawing and said, "You haven't even begun to look at this fish yet." Oh, good Zen, huh? Good Zen teaching, huh? The guy was heartbroken. The teacher said, "I'll come back in a couple of days. You let me know what you can really see in this fish." He spent two more days drawing different sides and aspects of the fish. And he said those 3 days, that particular training, he said later, was the foundation of his entire graduate work and his whole career as a botanist. So, you see the parallel here, right? The parallel. One of the parallels is that it's hard and frustrating, and that the breath isn't very interesting at first, or at second, or at third. But, take another look. Without the mantra, without the gata, without the Hail Mary, take another look. And this is what we call, in traditional Buddhism, slowing consciousness and emotional impulse down. Those are the last two of the five aggregates that make up the fictional self. Emotional impulse and consciousness. So it's slowing them down so we can appreciate our more primal experience, our more primal sensory experience, and the perceptions that come out of that experience. Of just being here, regardless of how we're feeling, regardless of what's going on, just noticing, just appreciating each color, each sound, each feeling that comes kinesthetically through us, each one. And that's our practice, slowing it down. And that's not a practice, it's part of our culture. Our culture goes very fast, and our culture is going faster and faster all the time in a technological way. And that's fine, that's cool, but if we get as revved up as, the number of hits we get in Google in 1 minute, you know, we're going to be in bad shape. We already are in bad shape, you guys. We already are. But we have this still nature. And in the retreat I said, you can think of our still nature as being a radio station that's playing silence. That's just playing stillness. That's just playing the shakuhachi music of no shakuhachi music. It's just still. So that when you get tired of the top 10 tunes, you you go to the stillness station. Or you find the stillness station that actually those top 10 tunes in your head are embedded in. They're embedded in that stillness station. And you can come back to that anytime. Not later on when you're feeling better, but anytime. Or when you're feeling worse, or when you're feeling more competitive, or whatever. Problem is that we get competitive about this practice. He's sitting better than she is. I'm sitting better than you are. And we just notice that. We notice that that's our tune number three, is how am I doing compared with everybody else. Sometimes that's my top tune, but sometimes it moves back to number three, and then number two is how can I be more compassionate because I'm a Buddhist, and right? Which is a fine tune too. I'm not saying we need to listen to the tunes. Well, we can't help not listening to tunes. So as we do this, the mind begins to stay. but it actually never really stays. Because nothing ever really stays. So as soon as we say, then it's going. It's going, going, gone. So this education is what we get from this practice. We get this education. We didn't get this education in school. It's still not in school. They're always talking about separation of church and state, but I'm not talking about church when I'd like to see this in our education, but I don't know. Since it gets all mixed up with religion, it probably never get in our school. Because is it going to be Buddhist or Christian or Hindu or the mantra or breathing, and everyone fighting about that, right? But at least if you're with kids, if you have nieces, nephews, or grandkids, or kids, you can be still with them sometimes. And if they aren't still, maybe you can take them outside, as I was saying the other day, and just look at the sky with them. I mean, I used to try to get my kids to come to Zen Center here for years. My son would never come. My daughter would come to Sunday school here. But Sunday school she didn't get anything from Sunday. No, Sunday school was fun. It's just that she didn't learn how to calm down and get still for Sunday school. But we'd just lie on our backs in the grass and breathe together. Until they ran off. And then after a while they just ran off for good. But that's, everything's running off anyway, so. But everything comes back. Now I've got grandkids. I'm waiting for my first opportunity. Lie in the grass. My grandkids. See them run off. So I want to finish by talking about the kind of the tricky part about this concentration, about becoming a master of samadhi. The tricky part of this is that you can never become a master of samadhi. That's the tricky part. The tricky part is that you can't become a master of anything. In the first place, you is just this conglomeration of change, changing events. In the second place, your project or what your mastery of is just conglomeration of change. So how can you become a master? You can't become a master. And yet, we become corrupted when we think we've got something down. It's a corruption. We think we've got it. I think I've got it. I'm here. I'm up here. Look, you guys are all paying attention. Nobody's falling asleep. I've been talking for, 41 minutes. And you've almost been wrapped. Not wrapped enough, but almost. See, that's this inner critic, right? Not wrapped enough. So the corruption of thinking that we've got something. And that's a human flaw. Human flaw. I mean, it's fine to say, I'm proud, yeah, wonderful. But then let it go. Let it go on the out breath. Let it go all the way out. If it goes all the way out, then you're not corrupt anymore. You let the corruption go. And it comes back in, and you're so delighted by it, you want to keep it, and you get corrupted. But it's going to leave, and then you're uncorrupted. So don't worry about being corrupted or uncorrupted. It's all the same thing. In and out, up and down. So in the Heart Sutra, I'll finish by, as I did on Thursday, by talking about the Heart Sutra. In the Heart Sutra, which we chant every day at Zen Center, and was chanted at Zen Centers all over the world, and don't ask me why. It's a weird sutra in many ways, very weird. I'm not going to get into how weird it is today. That's Red Pine can do that. He did that. No, actually, he showed its beauty and its relevance. He didn't talk about its weirdness. But I'd be glad to do that sometime. The Heart Sutra is about Buddha, one of Buddha's main men, Shariputra, who's mastered concentration, who's mastered samadhi, and who's considered wise. because he's a man of jnana, J-N-A-N-A, man of insight, and he is being critiqued. He is being put down for his corruption of insight. No, he's not being put down. Avalokiteshvara isn't putting him down. Just pointing out that he's been corrupted by his insight. He's stuck on his insight. He thinks he's got it. So sometimes we don't have very much, but we think we've got it. Sometimes we have a lot, but we think we've got it. And this practice is about releasing that thing that we think we've got. Releasing it, and then allowing it to be. Allowing it to be where it is. So the story I told on Thursday was about E. Fuller Torrey. 25 years ago, E. Fuller Torrey, I think in Washington, D.C. I didn't look it up still. E. Fuller Torrey began wondering about the homeless people who were in Washington, D.C., who were frequenting the grates, you know, where the warm air comes up outside, and were living out there. And E. Fuller Torrey was a fairly unusual psychiatrist, I would say a very idiosyncratic, weird psychiatrist, in a good sense. And he was so drawn to these people that he began to go outside. He began to go outside, and he met a woman who lived on a grate. And this woman had a cardboard box on her grate. And she lived in that cardboard box. That cardboard box kind of shielded her from people who came by and from the wind. And the grate gave her the warmth. And she lived there. She lived there in her cardboard box. So he started going out every day. And he started offering her. At first, she didn't want to have anything to do with him. But he just went out every day. He just went out and kind of mirrored her. Was there with her and saw that she really was a cigarette butt woman. So he started bringing cigarettes. And he would only give her one cigarette a day. But he gave her a cigarette a day. And she had nothing but butts for years. So they began to develop some rapport. Some tobacco rapport. Well, is there anything wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with that? We meet the person where he is, where she is. Not where we think they should be. That's what Avalokiteshvara does in the Heart Sutra. Shariputra thinks he's got something. So he doesn't meet people where they are anymore. See, when you've got something, you don't do that anymore. Avalokiteshvara's got nothing. Got nothing. Except availability. Except the warmth and love that come out of breathing in and breathing out. And so, E. Fuller Torrey keeps coming every day, and then finally after a week or 10 days, he tells her that she can be living inside, that he has a rooming house with a room that he knows of up the street, and he knows how to get the rent paid, and she can come inside. But she doesn't want to come inside. She's scared. She's got her cardboard box. Her cardboard box is safe. Her grate gives her the warm air. She's safe there. Not completely safe, but she's got something. She's got an identity there. She doesn't want to give it up. He keeps coming back. He keeps staying slow with her, staying easy with her, until she's ready to try it. Until she's ready to try it. I don't know how many packs of cigarettes it takes. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. This is not about cigarettes or not cigarettes. And then she goes in and lives inside. And I don't know if she lives happily ever after or not. Probably not. Nobody lives happily ever after. But at least, according to the story, she never lives outside again. So, we carry around our identities. My identity as a grandfather, my new wonderful identity. My identity as a Zen teacher. We carry around those identities. But on the out-breath, let's just let them go. Let them go. Because if we hang on to them, we just got this cardboard box that we're carrying everywhere. And actually, the only reason that she agrees to move inside is that Itafulatori tells her she can bring her cardboard box with her. So she brings her cardboard box inside, and she sets it up. She sets it up in her one room, and he comes in and he admires the cardboard box. And she starts drawing on her cardboard box, and he admires the painting she does on the cardboard box. And he brings some flowers in to put in a little vase by the cardboard box, because he's the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who's nobody special, just you and me. Just you and me when we're present. We're present for ourselves and for others. That's all. That's all. You don't have to be someone special. But the psychiatrist had to get stuff up to do that, right? He had to give, what, $200 an hour, and have all the nurses kowtowing to him, and, you know, passing meds continually. Who wanted to do that? You know, he had to give that stuff up. But did he think of it as a sacrifice? No. No. It's just being present. Just being present. The reward was the presence of this woman, of the life that she exhibited there on the grate, smoking cigarettes with him, and then in her apartment, with a cardboard box. So in the Heart Sutra, or in Mahayana Buddhism, the first, or I would say the base level awakening through samadhi practice is that everything's transient but the Buddha nature. Everything's transient but this one radio station that's always anchoring us. That's the first teaching. And that's the one Shariputra knows. That's the one part Shariputra doesn't know. But he doesn't know that the Buddha nature, so-called inner peace, is not different from the transiency. That the quiet radio station, the silent radio station, is not separate from the top 10 tunes. And he also doesn't know that the Prajnaparamita, which is the name of this sutra, the Prajnaparamita, says that things are neither what they are nor what they seem to be. And that's what Avalokiteshvara is teaching. It's teaching. I'll do a quick take on the etymology, although some of you haven't memorized by now. I've done this so many times. Shariputra is a man of jnana. J-N-A-N-A. which is knowledge, knowledge based on samadhi. But Avalokiteshvara is a master of prajna, P-R-A-J-N-A, before knowledge, beginner's mind, just the breathing, just the sky, just the cardboard box. Don't throw out the cardboard box. We all carry around cardboard boxes. Take care of the cardboard box. Paint on the cardboard box. Have friends over and dance around the cardboard box. Prajna, before insight. And then paramita, going beyond being before insight, to include intellect, memory, education, all that stuff that Itafulatori needed. If he had just gone out with beginner's mind, if he didn't have any sense about homelessness or depression or how to work with people who are really, really depressed, and this woman was almost catatonic in her depression. If he hadn't done the paramita part, but with just the prajna, it wouldn't have worked. But Avalokiteshvara's teaching us how to do both. How to do both the focus and the comprehension of context, the paying attention to context. So Basho's poem again, the last line of his poem, in plum flower scent, the sun pop, the sun appears, mountain path. So we're leaving here in a few minutes. We have our mountain path. We always have our mountain path, regardless of how unenlightened or enlightened we are. We have our opportunity to do this practice, to do this breathing practice, this being present practice, with ourselves and with others. So I think that's what I want to say this morning. And what I've said before. And what I'll be saying again. And I know you'll get kind of bored, but I don't know. I get bored too sometimes. I get bored with my own words. Time for one question, maybe, or one comment. A question or a comment? A question or a comment?
Yeah, earlier you were talking about being fused with story, and I just kind of confused me a little bit because I mean, I know there's this fusion, and then when you differentiate things, but then we got to
I didn't talk about being fused with your story. We do get fused with our stories, but that's not the fusion that I'm talking about through this. Comes from this practice. Our fusion with our stories creates confusion because we've got so many different stories, so many different cons, so many different ways that we're trying to fuse with this, with that, this story. I should be like this. I should be more practicing this way. I should live this way. So we're always confused. Fusion is simply just coming back and being with whatever it is, without running after them and trying to compare them and trying to shape them up, just being with them, which starts with your breath, simply with your breath, but can also start with looking at the sky or listening to your heartbeat. Start wherever you choose to make it start.